It's the Who Killed JC edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the Ides of March, faith and crime, the new Pope's old sins, and atheism versus religious freedom. Let's begin episode 203.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and sports, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan.
Yes.
Trivia question.
Yes.
Name the first president of the United States.
First president, that would be Lyndon Johnson.
No. You know the obvious answer.
Washington?
And when was he elected?
That was like 10 years after the end of the Revolutionary War.
Oh, but what happened in those between years? So 1789, mm-hmm. he was elected.
Right.
But a lot of people don't realize that from 1777 to 1789... there was the Articles of Confederation, in which they had actually 11 presidents between them. So technically, George Washington isn't the first president of the United States. He's merely the first president of the United States under the Constitution.
Yeah, or something like that. Like, he's the first president of the United States, or some funny way of saying it.
Yes. But in the meantime, I'm quite sure that... that the people of the United States are they're quite relieved, because, I mean, they just passed one of the most deadliest times of years. I mean, we all know the cliffhanger. We left you with last week, folks, if you remember.
Mm.
Who killed JC? And, of course, by JC, we mean...
Julius Caesar. Julius the Caesar. Only JC. Yes, because, Don, this past Thursday was March 14th. And did you beware the Ides of March, Don?
I always am aware of the Ides of March, because... you know, if the eyes get me. Oh, no, Ides. Not eyes. Oh, wow.
Ides. Yes, yes.
Well, I'm aware of both of them.
Good. That's excellent. So the Ides of March is actually a reference to the middle of the month, of certain months of the Roman calendar, and was observed as sort of a religious holiday for different gods. However, we most remember the Ides for the assassination of Julius Caesar. Don, you remember how Caesar died?
It was an inside job, wasn't it? From what I remember, it was.
Yes, it was. It was a conspiracy.
It was one of the few times when you can actually say, yes, a conspiracy theory is appropriate in this particular instance.
Oh, was it? He was stabbed to death near the Theater of Pompeii on March 15th. 44 BCE, and he was, of course, stabbed by his fellow senators.
Well, I heard actually it was only one person, but then you had the magic knife theory, which says it was impossible, so that's when they said, well, it had to be more than one person.
Clearly Photoshop, though. Anyway, Don, do you know what Caesar's last words were?
Et tu, Brute?
Yes, so more commonly known as either you too, child, or you too, Brutus.
So is that like some slam of Brutus saying, hey, you're just a kid, or does Brutus mean child in Latin?
Well, see, the interesting thing is there's some historic controversy that Caesar was acknowledging as he died that Brutus was his illegitimate son. But that doesn't seem to add up too much considering the evidence. I think Caesar was only about 14 years older than Brutus.
Yeah, well, they did it.
I mean,
back
it's
in the
possible, old days, I suppose. Caesar was a little bit.
Well, actually, and the Romans had a weird thing where you would adopt people. Like, I mean, it wasn't nowadays it's like a big thing to adopt a child. Back then, you were doing left, right, and center.
Yeah, it was. It was a different idea of sort of the family structure back then. But the interesting thing is the last words of Caesar are a historic controversy for a different reason, in that we don't actually know what Caesar's last words were. And the famous lines, either you too, Brutus, or you too, child, comes from actually the bard Shakespeare from his Julius Caesar play, which he wrote in 1599. And in fact, those lines were not inventions of Shakespeare. Those were sort of common, I guess you could call them pop culture references in other literature about the death of Julius Caesar.
You mean there weren't the Zebrida tablets lying around that actually recorded the events as they were happening?
No. Unfortunately, the only reliable historians from the time period, well, I guess not the time period, actually, were Suetonius, who lived from about 69 CE to 122, and Plutarch from 46 CE to 120. So you're looking at about a good 80 to 90 years after the fact. A
couple of generations.
Yeah. Both state that Caesar said nothing, and he simply pulled his toga over his head before dying. Which is, I mean, an interesting thing for him to do, I suppose. I suppose he was kind of surprised.
Yeah, well, you know, a little too little, too late. Maybe he thought he was Superman with his cape or whatever.
Well, I remember from the HBO TV series Rome, I believe Caesar, when he pulls his toga over, it's like a symbol of the whatever rank he was calling himself at the time or something, like proconsul or something. So it was sort of like his last, you know, I die Roman senator or something like that.
Julius Caesar had a lot of issues, too, from what I understand. I mean, like, there's and this, again, this is myth versus reality. Mm. Receding hairlines. He wasn't the most handsomest person in the world. Whether did he really want to become the sort of autocratic ruler everyone thought he did, or did he just figure, we need to straighten things out, and I'm the guy to do the job, you know?
It is tough to figure. Caesar was a man of many myths, we could say. We don't know too much about him, and I think that it's unfortunate because he was an interesting figure. You look at some of the, I guess you could call them contemporaries, people like Napoleon or Alexander the Great or others, and you kind of wonder, you know, what really went on in their heads.
Well, and he's spurred so many. I mean, Caesar itself has become synonymous with almost every form of royalty, at least in Western culture, is derived from that.
Well, I mean, his adopted son, Augustus, took the term Caesar as meaning emperor.
Yeah.
And Tsar is Russian for Caesar.
Yeah, actually, I think there's a few more entomologies of Caesar that goes beyond that. Granted, it's not coming to mind. But speaking of entomologies.
Yes.
Do you know how the human Romans used the term Ides, sort of what our equivalent would be today?
I think it's like mid-March, something like that.
Sort of. As it turns out, the Romans were not really big on sort of the days of the week. In fact, they distinguished where they were in a month based sort of on the moon. So they start off with sort of a new moon, which they called the Calades. The next was sort of the half moon, which was the Nones, N-O-N-E-S, which sounds like the plural of none, but it's actually Latin and means something other than nothing.
Right.
And the new moon was the Ides. So that's sort of what the base of theory is. In reality, it worked out that the first day of the month was called the Calade. The fifth or the seventh of the month, depending whether it was long or short month, was the Nona. And by long and short months, we sort of think of, you know, January is 31 months, February is 28. In Roman times, most of the months were 28 days, and they had, what was it? March, May, Quintilis, which is July. I think Quintilis sounds so much better than July. Man. Mm. And October had 31. So the famous Ides fell on the 13th or the 15th of the month. Now, it gets even weirder from there, because at least from our perspective, all their dates make reference to the next moon. So the 2nd of March would be the five knowns of March, or 5 days inclusive to the next known of March. If today's date would be the 14th calend of April, because you'd go to the next one, and the 1st of April is 14 days away. And actually, where you're getting the festival from, I think, from the research I was doing on this, is in February. February had two halves of the month. So you had everything up to the knowns, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, it was a little past that. What was it? The 23rd. It was the 23rd of the month. Was sort of the end of February, first part. And then they had a second part. And what they would do is whenever you had a sort of leap year, except for them, it was a leap month. they put in a leap month, and quite often that month ended up getting called by one festival or another, which is where you get the idea of festivals sort of appearing in the mid of the month.
Hmm.
So, weird.
Yeah, Romans were weird people. But speaking of, nothing like this. Completely different topic, actually, Don.
Oh, yes, and not a great segue.
Thank you.
The new study raises questions about religion as a deterrent against criminal behavior. When priests go wild. No, we'll talk about that later. A U.S. study found that purposeful distortion and genuine ignorance of hardcore criminals will lead them often to co-opt religious doctrine to justify and further their criminal activities. In the study, they commented in their conclusion that people have to understand that presenting religious doctrine to people isn't enough to change their behavior. The research of Tupali et al., which is an analysis of a series of interviews, was published this month in the Journal of Theoretical Criminology in an article called "With God on My Side, the Paradoxical Relationship Between Religious Belief and the Criminal Among the Hardcore Street Offender." That's wow. A long title.
Yeah.
At least made sense. The interview showed that criminals will often employ elaborate and creative rationalizations to reconcile their belief in God and their serial offending. At least that's what the research concluded. Just for reference, in 2007, Corrections Canada reported on its website that about 15 to 20% of federal inmates regularly attend religious worship and study. The one main premise, or according to this research article, of religion, with regards to its sort of unique ability to instill ethical behavior on its believers, is the notion that there is an afterlife where one will be punished for their sins or crimes. That an all-knowing deity has their eye on them sort of like 24/7, and thus religion claims to be able to control human behavior. Now, of course, there's been a lot of research on this, but most of it's been mixed at best. Recidivism, or criminals who break the law more than once, there doesn't really seem to be any correlation between their belief or their strength of belief and them actually reoffending. In fact, one study, and yeah, okay, it's one study, so it's interesting but not conclusive, but I like to poke that religious bear.
Mm-hmm.
One study actually showed a higher correlation with high-performing religious prisoners than their fellows, and high performance in this context is defined by the number and variety of religious activities that they went in prison. Now, of course, according to the paper, previous research suggests that many offenders experience a heightened sense of futurelessness and fatalism as a consequence of growing up and living in economically depressed, high crime, not much opportunity sort of thing, and where there's always a chance of death around every corner. From this, the researchers thought it apparent that offenders must have to deal with, you know, sort of the anticipated guilt of committing a crime and that sort of existential fear of losing one's life while committing a crime. But they wanted to see what effect a belief in an afterlife would have in mediating their behavior, i.e., if I don't feel guilty or I'm worried about my life, what role does religious belief play in deterring them from actually committing crime because they might get punished in an afterlife? Now, the study was performed on 48 active criminals on the street. Average age was 26, six of them were women. Now, this is what they call a qualitative study, i.e. they sat down and did a nice long interview with these people as opposed to some sort of questionnaire or statistical analysis. About half the interviews were done in the private offices of one of the researchers on campus. The others were sort of done in the wild, at like McDonald's, in a park, on a street corner. Most of them assumed that they have a... So out of the results, most of them assumed that they would have an early death. The fear of death was often mediated with religion, that when it was their time, it would be like divine retribution. Now that it seems like that's what one would expect. But the study took a turn to the unexpected, at least for the theistic crowd, when you go a bit further. So essentially, just to recap, they lived in poverty, they knew they were going to die, and they kind of expected that when it's my time to die, God will tell me it's time to die. Most of the participants actually thought that their religious beliefs sanctioned their criminal behavior, and that these people sort of fell into three distinct groups. First, offenders' religious beliefs may have been sort of incomplete. So many of the interviewees lacked a clear or comprehensive understanding of the precepts, rules, and expectations of faith. So they know of church, but they don't really understand what the faith means. Now, I'm going to throw out some people's names here. These are the names that the interviewees use themselves. So I'm not trying to be colorful here, but it's... So Triggerman, a street enforcer, said, "I mean, anything can be forgiven. We live in hell now, and you can do anything in hell. When it all ends... We go up to there, to heaven, and the devil comes down here. Only the devil lives in hell forever, man, all by himself. God has to forgive everyone, even if they don't believe in him." Which I think if the Pope had something to say about it, he might disagree.
Right.
Detroit, a late 40s criminal, said, "There is a heaven and there is a hell, but I believe that it is hell on earth, and we're trying to fight to get to there, to heaven." These people seem to know God in sort of the cartoon sense, but they lack a real understanding of sort of the ethics of organized religion. Via their personal views, they dare say they have a relationship with God, but they think that their behavior sort of is in line with doctrine, even though if you talk to a priest or anyone, they'd say, well, no, you misunderstood the message. The second group, their religious beliefs tend to be more selective. Some offenders were aware of religious doctrine, but seemed to manipulate or selectively attend to certain precepts and ignored others to sort of accommodate their sort of self-serving desire to offend. So Stunna, one of the participants, said, well, you do get punished for doing wrong things, but not if you don't have a choice. It's like this here. See, I go and I rob a motherfucker and, well, then I'm still going to go to heaven because, you know, Jesus, he knows I ain't got a choice, you know? He knows I got a decent heart. He knows I'm stuck in the hood and I'm just doing what I got to do to survive. Cool, a 20-something drug dealer, saw theology like this. You go and you do something bad and then you ask for forgiveness and Jesus has to give it to you, you know, wipe your slate clean. Also, if I go rob a dope dealer or a muster or something like that, it don't count against me because it's like I'm giving punishment to them for Jesus. That's God's will. Which is quite an interesting take on things, I thought.
Yeah.
Many offenders expressed a great deal of faith in the forgiving nature of God vis-a-vis themselves and believed that if there was a hell, it was reserved for others. So from the study, they state, They were all recruited from neighborhoods where religious institutions, i.e. churches, maintained a consistent presence, where many of them had significant exposure to such institutions' instruction since they were children. Consequently, a number of them seemed to know enough about their religion to argue convincingly that their behavior was in fact permissible, if not condoned. Thus, their beliefs may be technically accurate to state doctrine, but paradoxically is antithetical to the approved religious form. Offenders frequently applied their knowledge of religion to support their offending with specific recognition of an omnipotent higher power that permitted or even wanted them to continue their offending. According to Butler, a 31-year-old male robber, if God wasn't forgiving, I wouldn't be living. If we're playing to God, he's probably protecting you and all that kind of stuff. Another robber put it like this, I pray, right? And to me, it keeps me out there longer until it gets to a point where it seems like God says, well, I can't let you get along. See, I do believe that people can change, but that has to come from the Most High. I'm getting high to the day I die. I'm doing this until the day I die, unless the Most High intercedes, that is, i.e. God comes in and says, hey, it's time for you to change your ways. Until that happens, they see that they have sort of a justification. God has sanctioned their criminal activity. So a growing correctional reform that pertains to this sort of study is based on the idea that there's a lot more faith-based programs going out there, especially under Bush. We're getting that now here under Harper. However, to the extent that the offenders misinterpret or distort religious techniques to justify their excuses crime, we have to think about the sort of faith-based approach to criminal rehabilitation. In fact, most of the studies that did show that, you know, religious intervention changed the recidivism, the criminal activity, wasn't so much the churching, but it was the other things that the clerics in prison would do. So helping them with tax forms, helping them how to write a resume, helping them get in contact with the family. The sort of social aspects of it seems to be the more telling traits that actually showed how successful this kind of intervention was. And religion was really just sort of an excuse to these people to do what they were going to do. I guess I mean that both ways, too.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, we do know that religion can serve as another form of rationalization. I mean, we all rationalize what we do, of course. And if you're a criminal, I mean, you're probably not going to go through life, unless you're, I guess, like an exceptional criminal, self-loathing and being, oh, I wish I wasn't a criminal. Why do I do these things? You're probably going to go through life going, you know, yeah, that guy that I robbed got what he deserved. I mean, yeah, that drug deal that I did, of course, that was my only option. And
well, actually, and it's good, but you just point out one thing, too, that I kind of mentioned the social aspect. The other area where actually these interventions tend to, like, you know, sort of the faith-based or not necessarily faith-based, had its effect was in alcohol and drug addiction. Mm. And again, you know, so I think there are people who commit crimes and they really, you know, I hate myself for doing this, but if you're addicted to a drug or you need that next fix, you're going to do things that you don't want to do, but you kind of sort of have to do. So I think in that sense, there is a level of criminal that would fall into that category.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of them, I think, fall into the other camp.
Well, it's funny, too, because like, as you were talking about that, I was reminded of, you know, like watching The Sopranos or any sort of gangster movie, and those kind of rationalizations come through very often. This kind of, the world is effed up, and, you know, I'm going to let God sort it out. I'm just going to do what I do and make my money and survive and, you know, feed my family type thing. And it makes perfect sense. You would use whatever rationalization options you have available to look yourself in the mirror in the morning.
Which kind of makes me wonder if The Sopranos weren't channeling that. Because if you faint, you watch The Sopranos.
Well, I mean,
that's how they ended up on it. They were saying that this psychologist was actually being an enabler for Tony to do his bad things.
You kind of, Sopranos, there were some stories that maybe The Sopranos had a few inside sources for some of their writers to get a good feel for the criminal mind.
Yes, until they popped a cap in there.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
Gee, your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part 4 of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Man in the Morning.
I will say B,
Peru.
I'll do it.
And that's your final answer?
Yes.
You can buy a new car. You just want
$33,055.78.
To everyone who donated to this year's fund drive, CITR would like to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone who helped us meet and exceed our goal of $30,000. Your generous donations help us support local artists, businesses, and marginalized voices in the community. Here's to another 75 years of campus and community radio.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR.
So, Ian, is it true?
What's true?
Does the Pope in the woods? Oh, wait a minute. There's a bear in there. No, sorry.
New Pope. That's the name of this segment here. We got a new Pope, but is he a better Pope, or is he the same old Pope? Is he just another Pope in wolf's clothing? Is he going to Pope any better than the last Pope?
I saw one of the best cartoons ever. So people who may or may not be aware, one of the rituals that Catholics do is they have incense, and they sort of wave the incense around, and they have a picture of the new Pope waving the incense, saying, "I just can't get rid of this old man stink." That was funny.
Yes.
So, disrespectful note. On a more respectful note.
Yes. Well, respectful for us. The retirement of Ratzinger left, of course, a vacancy at the top of the Catholic Church ladder. And they have elected a new pope, George Mario Bergoglio, I think, who has taken the name of Francis. Now, this is interesting for a couple of reasons, because he is, one, first, the first non-European pope. And he's also the first Jesuit pope.
Now, he is the a bishop from Argentina.
Yes.
And yes, I technically was born in Argentina. But both his parents are Italian. So I suspect, I don't know this, and I am being a pain in the butt as far as being picky about this. But technically, if you are the, you know, second generation, he may even be first, I'm not sure where he was born, but it's hard to say that he's from South America any more than it's like me saying I'm Native American because I was born in Canada, but really.
Well, no, I mean, he was born in Argentina. He did spend his entire life there. So, I mean, he's as Argentinian as most Argentinians.
I think a lot of Argentinians would argue with that.
Well,
I mean, how many times have we sat here and we've argued when you sit there and you say, why do we let all these... No, sorry, you know, you've never said that. But, I mean, we have a lot of people who are first or second generation immigrants to this country. And, I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But some people say, well, you're not really one of us until you've been here for five or six generations at least. So,
if you go back five or six generations, no one is going to be Argentinian. I mean, at a certain point, you're going back like 500 years.
No, five generations is like 200 years, if that.
Well, I don't know.
Each generation is about 30 years.
Well, it depends on what you mean by generation, then.
Yes. But anyway.
Like I said, I think he is the first non-European pope. He's also the first Jesuit pope. And much has been made about him not being a European, which I think is interesting because, as we've talked about on the show before, Europe is no longer a power base for the Catholic Church. So this decision seems to make a bit more sense. South America is one of the largest Catholic populations in the world. And as we've talked about before, places like Africa and Asia are sort of growing domains for the Catholic Church as opposed to shrinking domains like Europe.
Yeah, I think I heard an interesting stat. They were commenting that about 40% of Catholics are from South America, but 60% of cardinals come from Europe.
Yeah. Well, again, generational gap thing going on there. So there's been some discussion of whether or not this new pope is any better or worse than the old pope. Now, admittedly, it is hard to top Ratzinger in terms of being terrible. But that being said, this new pope is not without controversy. So there have been some claims, some unsubstantiated claims, nevertheless, that he collaborated with the dictatorship in Argentina, even suggesting that he played a role in the kidnapping of two priests by the government. Now, these claims were never actually brought to trial, and aside from the claims of the priests, there actually is no evidence. So, it's basically hearsay.
Well, yes and no. So, you're right. The specific claim you're making, I would put to hearsay. But he's doing one of the things, and this, I was listening to a podcast just before he came into the studio today, that says that maybe this is a good point for him. In Argentina, he was a bishop, but he wasn't a high-ranking authority, but he was not a low-ranking authority in Argentina during the junta. And a lot of bad things were going on. And there's always this sort of tension as to, do I stand up and say something, and then they cart me off and I die, or do I sit back and kind of hold my tongue and hope to do the best that I can for those people around me? And he suffered through a lot of this sort of angst, same way sort of that a lot of people did in Europe during the Nazis, right? So, and I'm not condemning him for that. But, I mean, he was kind of implicated in the sense that he didn't speak up and he didn't say anything at the time. But where the hope lies is that after the junta had disappeared and he became the leader of the Catholics in Argentina, from what I just heard, he went out and he said, sorry, you know, we it was a horrible thing. We should have done more. We didn't do as much as we could. We're really, really sorry about that. And one of the things that may be a bit of light for Francis is that they're hoping that maybe he can take this sort of maicopa that he did for that, where he did kind of have some personal guilt, and maybe apply that to the main Catholic Church with the whole pedophilia and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where most accounts says he's got no worries in that way, unlike Ratzinger.
Well, the thing is, he's at least right now is known for being more willing to face apologies. He's not the kind of hard line, I'm going to draw a line in the sand and never cross a type person. That being said, he is a Catholic and he is going to say stupid, really stupid things. So, for example, on the subject of abortion and euthanasia, the Pope has called them part of a culture of death. He has opposed distribution of free contraceptives in Argentina, which is ironic since he also wants to combat poverty. And one of the big correlations between poverty in these places, parts of the world, is lack of access to contraceptives.
I'm sorry to do this, Ethan. It's Argentina, not Tinia.
That's what I'm saying.
No, you're saying Tinia.
No. Anyway, in Argentina, he also called same-sex marriage, quote, devil's work. So, not exactly a nice guy, but perhaps a little bit nicer than Ratzinger. On the subject of the sort of sexual abuse scandals, he, I think, has at least led a little bit better in maybe a more progressive way. He has sort of not tried to kind of hide the pedophiles. He's said some relatively hopeful things and made a few remarks that seem to be a breath of fresh air in that respect, but still lagging behind the rest of the world in almost every other respect. So we'll have to see. Time will tell ultimately if this Pope turns out to be, you know, better.
Well, again, and I don't mean to ambush Ethan on this. I just happened to listen to a podcast before we came here. It was actually interesting, some of the things that they had mentioned about him, and I'll try not to be too long about this, but that one of the reasons why they pick him, because he was a reformer. Now, reformer in the Catholic context is not what we think of. So as you say, it's not like he's going to say, hey, abortion's okay, gay people, hey, we love you all, that sort of thing. But you do have the idea of the pedophile. But other things, and we've mentioned on the show before, the financial system and the money of the Catholic Church is considered to be very, very corrupt. And they're hoping that he's going to be a clean broom to sweep in there. The bureaucracy, which again, they think, you know, partly with Ratzinger beforehand and some of his other main contenders, that is part of the problem that they want to sort of fix and change. But of course, one of the problems he has is he was sort of seen as an outsider. And as an outsider, they say, well, that's going to give him sort of the leeway to maybe make some real change, again, in the limited context of the Catholic Church, but make some real change. But he has to face the bureaucracy, and the Catholic Church is famous for the depth and the Byzantineness of its bureaucracy, if I can swap East and Western churches. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it will be interesting, if only from a sort of geopolitical kind of, you know, I don't care about the religion part, but how does politics play out? How he's going to do, if he's going to do anything, or whether he's going to end up sort of spinning his wheels because he's going to want to change things, but the whole bureaucracy around him is just going to make him impotent.
Well, it also depends on, I think, on the cardinals that elected him. Do they want him to be a crusading pope, or do they want him to basically be, you know, a photo op and go around in his pope mobile and wave and kiss babies or whatever it is popes do?
Well, and that, again, that I think is actually the crux of it, is, I mean, they picked him because they wanted change. Now, did they want real change, as in, is he actually going to clean things up, or did they want to pick the poster child for change in the Catholic Church and just use him on posters and not actually have him change anything in reality?
It'd be funny if they actually did print up posters and, like, both the new pope.
Oh, actually, no, it's funny. I was, again, in my research for the show, they had, like, the top 10 pope trinkets that you can buy. So keychains and postcards and posters and all sorts of no pope on a rope, though. I was
no, that's too bad.
Yeah, pope on a no, that's Jesus.
Well, let's take another quick break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back after this.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Standing on a planet, really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
But
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So I wanted to talk a bit about atheism and religious freedom. And we've discussed this actually on the show many times, and we've actually kind of touched on it today with Don's earlier segment about chaplains and religious motivation for prisoners. So we're going to touch on that again. So what is the importance of freedom of religion and freedom from religion? This means that people should be free to believe whatever they want, even if they want to be Christian, Muslim, or Pastafarian. Governments, law enforcement should not be coming down on them for what they choose to believe. So likewise, people should be free to not believe. Atheism, agnosticism should not be criminal offenses, just like it shouldn't be a criminal offense to be a Christian. I think everybody is on board with that. It's not too controversial. We all think that religious freedom would naturally include freedom from religion. However, the UN doesn't seem to think that. Yes. So the European Union, supported by the South American group, tabled a resolution at the United Nations Human Rights Council on freedom of religion or belief. So Dr. Elizabeth O'Casey, who is a representative of CFI Transnational, was present at these meetings and lobbied for better inclusion of non-believers in the writing of the Act. So to quote her, quote, "I attended one of the informal consultation meetings on this resolution and argued for non-believers as a category meriting explicit mention within the context of discrimination, particularly given the severity and breadth of such discrimination against non-believers and people of no religion around the world." She also goes on to say, "We suggested that a mention of non-believers might be included specifically in a paragraph on violence against individuals, where the original paragraph expressed deep concern at the increasing number of acts of violence directed against individuals, including persons belonging to religious minorities. We thought it possible to mention non-believers amongst such persons." Now, unfortunately, their response was that non-believers were already covered by the, quote, right to believe. Now, I think there's a couple problems with this. So first, in the case of religious believers, the authors of this resolution explicitly mention this group of people in order to highlight the types of discrimination they suffer from. So why would they not also explicitly mention non-believers as well? Secondly, the important thing to realize for this resolution is within the context of expressly underlying the institutionalized persecution and discrimination of non-believers, we're making an explicit category of people that can be future referenced in other UN resolutions or human rights resolutions. And from what I understand, that doesn't really exist right now. There's no accepted group of people classified as non-believers.
No, it's almost like sort of the libertarian stance that, well, listen, you know, any crime against a man and a woman will qualify for religion, ethnics, for all the other things, that really you just need the one set of law and applies to each one. But part of the evolution of the idea of minority rights and that sort of aspect is to identify particular groups that suffer from specific persecution. You know, that, I mean, before we had gender orientation as a specific group, you know, I mean, you needed to sort of say it out loud to recognize that there's a particular group that suffers a different kind of persecution than just men and just women, or, you know, race or religion or, you know, ethnicity, that sort of thing. I thought it was kind of interesting. I went out to do a bit of checking to see what kind of sort of what I think of as uniquely atheistic sort of discrimination that one could go out there. And one way that this is a sort of a unique discrimination, uniquely at least for atheists, is, for example, if you were in Ireland, or maybe even in Canada, the laws get a little thing, but any place that has sort of anti-blasphemy laws, I could be charged for saying that Sunday school is a form of child abuse because that's a religious, genuinely offensive to someone's religious feelings. Yet, if they say that non-believers were burned in hell or that I have no moral foundation, that seems to be okay, even though what they said, I think, is far more violent than what I had said. In many parts of the world, if you want a visa, you need to actually declare a religion. And if you don't have one, you either have to lie, which, of course, makes your application a criminal offense right in itself, or you have to get special permission. So there's these extra hurdles you have to go through. In parts of the world, you can't get married if you're not a member of a specific religious group. Marriage in Israel is extremely sectarian, that only Muslims can marry Muslims and they can only be married by imams, Jews by rabbis, etc. In fact, it was only as recently as 2010 that you could get sort of a civil union, and it's not really a marriage, it's more of a legal convenience. But, you know, even in what we consider to be sort of a progressive place in the Middle East, it's still really backwards by our own standards.
Yeah.
In Canada, you can, and again, the laws are a bit, no, actually, sorry, this particular example, in Canada, you can be refused or fired from a public school job if you happen to be one of the people applying at the 1,400 100% publicly funded Catholic schools in Ontario. And there are, of course, other similar schools outside of the Ontario precinct. And, of course, there is sort of the idea of social discrimination. So those are all sort of technical discriminations, but you think of social discrimination. Now, think about how impossible it is to be elected president of the United States if you ever professed your atheism. I mean, it's almost a given condition. In fact, at least a dozen states, I think it's a dozen states, specifically say in their constitution that you cannot hold public office if you are a non-believer. That you can be any religion you want, but you have to acknowledge a supreme being. We talked about prisons and religion. And in one case, in a study presented to the UN Council, in February 2007, the Newton Correctional Facility in Iowa conducted a state-funded program that provided literature to prisoners stating, quote, criminal behavior is a manifestation of an alienation between self and God. Acceptance of God and biblical principles result in cure through the power of the Holy Spirit. Transformation happens through the instantaneous miracle, and it builds the prisoner up with familiarity of the Bible. So active participants in this program, they received better cells, they got more privacy, they got better access to their relatives, and their prison sentences were reduced. They were much more likely to get things like parole and all that. And just parole in any of the states would be more likely if you say, I'm born again and I believe in that. The United States Army, they have this thing called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Tracking and Global Assessment Tool, which is a mandatory thing they have to do. And part of that is the spiritual fitness section, where if you answer it actually quite honestly as an atheist or non-religion, you're actually ranked as deficient. And that directly affects your ability to get advancement. And you're actually told to get counseling from your chaplain and do remedial activities.
Yeah,
basically, being an atheist can be very bad for your career in the military.
The military thing, I know I've read a lot of blog posts about that, especially from the Freedom from Religious Foundation. They've got some great material on that, if anyone's curious. But Don hit the nail on the head with a couple of those things. We're not necessarily talking about like violent religious persecution. That happens, of course, for non-believers. You know, we've heard the stories; they're terrible. But just sort of little things, little reminders that you're in a different category of person. And that is, I think, something that the UN also has to consider, because those things add up. That creates the culture of discrimination. And, you know, by not taking that extra step of saying, listen, non-believers are part of the equation of religious freedom, they're missing the boat on this.
Well, and there's another thing, too, with exactly what you're saying there. I mean, if I'm a Catholic in Iran, let's say, right? And I'm getting persecuted by the Islamic government. I have a Christian preacher or church I can call on to offer support because it's a recognized institution. But if I'm a non-believer, if I'm an atheist, I don't have any of that support structure, which oddly means in many ways I'm far more at risk of suffering persecution because there isn't that sort of secondary support structure that exists, which is why the UN needs to step up and help provide at least a context. I mean, if only I can go to the UN offices and say, help, help, I'm being repressed.
Yeah, exactly. So Now I kind of want to shift this to a bit closer to home, because I think there's an interesting parallel to this. So we've been hearing in the news lately about the dismissal of prison chaplains. And these are the folk who go into prisons to offer religious services to the prisoners. Mm-hmm. And we actually talked about this, I think, when it came up initially. But basically what's happened here is the government of Canada has decided to lay off 49 part-time prison chaplains. So while 31 of the 49 were Christian, the rest of them were the sole representatives of non-Christian religions. So because of this, BC, for example, is left without a non-Christian chaplain.
Actually, it's worse than that. Hmm. Of all the chaplains in Canada, two are Muslim. Everyone else is Christian.
Yeah, exactly. And so what's happened here is a group of them have lobbied a lawsuit against the Canadian government. So we have two Buddhists, two Wiccans, two Muslims, a Sikh, and a Jewish chaplain who believe...
They call them rabbis.
Are they Jewish chaplains? Rabbis. Chaplains become rabbis? I thought they were all chaplains.
No.
Okay, well, whatever. They are arguing that Corrections Canada is denying them reasonable access to offer religious and spiritual guidance, and they're suing the federal government. The idea here is that the chaplains are to be replaced with a mix of volunteers and 71 full-time Christian chaplains and the two Muslim chaplains Don mentioned. So I think as like maybe atheist skeptics, we might be tempted to say, oh, good, fire the rest of the chaplains too. But of course, we're just talking about religious freedom, and the fact of the matter is that religious freedom also means that you can't be denied religious counseling if you want it, even if you are a prisoner. So if you...
I wouldn't say it was wrong. It's unfair. Inconsistent.
Well, yeah, okay, inconsistent.
But yes, okay, continue.
Well, I mean, also, the other thing, too, is if you're a non-religious person and you want counseling, there you go, right? So what should the government be doing? It seems to me that if we want to have a consistent stance on religious freedom, then you need to have representatives for all religions on standby for prisoners. So I think maybe a rational approach would be to have full-time staff for the dominant religion. So I think the majority of our prisoners are probably either going to be Christian, maybe Native, well, probably Native, and you know, there'll probably be a smaller fraction of Muslim and Jewish people, a couple Wiccans. But you have sort of the main religions covered, and then you have maybe some part-time staff, and then maybe some volunteers who, for example, say you have a prisoner who's Wiccan who needs some counseling but lives in a remote prison. So the government would pay the expenses to transport a volunteer to that prison to offer counseling. I think that's a fair and pretty reasonable way for the government to handle this. You can't really, there's no way to justify, and from the point of view of saving budgetary funds, to cut a service that is required for religious freedom.
Yeah, no, actually, I agree. And one of the knee-jerk sort of responses to this is that, as you say, we should, government shouldn't fund any of this, and you should have the churches themselves fund it. But then, as you say, you get some people who will be literally left out. You'll have proselytizers who will have an added advantage.
Yeah.
On a weird note, I was doing some research for this as well, and I was doing the Pew Institute. They did a survey about what chaplains in the United States said, and they put up, you know, some of the religions you're going to have in there. Neo-paganism apparently is like one of the biggest growing religions in the church. I mean, still a small minority, but it's like one of the big ones, like Odinism, and even what they call atheistic Satanism, which I thought was a really weird term because, you know, atheist and Satan doesn't really go any better than atheist and God. Hmm. But the idea is Satan as the embodiment of anti-theism, right? So Satan was the individual. He's the one who rejected the change. But getting back to our topic, you're right. I mean, a lot of the idea of prison is for rehabilitation. And to have what I would call philosophical support to get rid of the baggage that I think we have here is an important part of that. You know, you had mentioned briefly about, you know, Natives. I mean, Natives famously are about, I think, 20 or 40% of our prison population, and relative to their actual percentage, it's horrible. But I mean, those in theory should all be sort of nativists as far as their religious beliefs go. I mean, a few of them converted, but I mean, you know, part of their whole getting out of the pit that history has put them in, which is why they're largely in there, is to have this reattachment with their cultural background to gain confidence in the whole thing. And they're not going to do that by going to praying to St. Francis. They're going to do that by going to the sweat lodge and doing all that. And essentially the government says, screw you.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too, and this is interesting, that about 20% of Canadians or Canada's prison population are non-believers. So, I mean, I think we've also talked about on the show whether or not we want things like humanist chaplains. I think there's obviously a lot of debate in our community about whether or not we want to go down that road. But it does lead you to the conclusion that we need at least some kind of secular representation, whether that is taking the form of sort of social workers who, as you were talking about earlier, go in, help you write a resume, line up job interviews, that kind of thing, or whether they're offering psychological counseling or discussion of ethics or talking about humanist literature or whatever. I think there needs to be some representation on that angle.
Yeah, and again, I would go more with sort of philosopher or ethicist that go in and talk to, and whatever your school of thought, you are still presenting sort of a philosophy. If it's Christian philosophy, great. If it's Aristotelian philosophy, great. You know, so you have one blanket term for everyone, and that does include the theist because it is a form of philosophy. And you're not subjugating one group to another. I mean, think about how isolating it must feel like when your bunkmate can say, "Well, I really need help, and I'm going to go call on my preacher, and the government's going to pay for him to come on down or Wiccan, whatever, right?" Whereas I'm an atheist, and I really need someone to talk to, and it's like, "Hello, hand."
Yeah, yeah. You know? The other thing that adds, I think, a layer to this that we should also mention is the whole freaking Office of Religious Freedom. What does that thing cost again? Like a couple $1 million?
Yeah.
I wonder, I don't know how much these chaplains get paid, but I'm going to guess that it wasn't as much as that Office of Religious Freedoms.
Well, let's not forget the other famous elephant in the room that's often made in my circles, that the government spent something like, was it $61 million on promoting itself? Saying, "Hey, your government's doing great because we did great things." And it tends to be more around election time than the rest of the time. But yeah, I mean, there are priorities and there are priorities.
Yeah.
And I think the conservative government sees prison to be largely a punitive, retribution, punishment sort of thing. And that only bad people go to prisons and they deserve whatever they get. Therefore, they're cut back as much. I mean, famously, they had pizza night and chicken night, which was a way for prisoners. You know, they'd spend sort of like, they'd get a pizza. It would cost them like $30 for a small pizza. But out of that $30, 15 of it went to a local charity. It was a good way. The prisoners, if they get good behavior and they did their work, they get this nice little treat. They felt good because they were supporting a local charity. But again, that was pulled out from underneath them too, because the current government doesn't see people as a priority.
Well, they see the Christians as a priority.
Let's be fair on this pony. I mean, they have put them at the top of the heap.
Yeah.
But they still cut, as you said, 31 Christian preachers. If they had cut only the other ones, you know. So they're cutting back on everyone.
Right.
But they're favoring their own. I think I can say their own.
Well, I mean, it does speak to, and this sort of ties back to the segment earlier, about what exactly we're expecting prison chaplains to accomplish. If we're simply providing them another form of rationalization for whatever it is they're there for, well, then that's not even really all that beneficial. And if the main source of benefit they're providing is that kind of sort of resume writing and social foundation that the prisoners are going to need when they get out, you don't need the religious baggage that much. But again, I think that it is interesting and it is telling to look at how we view quote-unquote religious freedom versus freedom from religion. And I think that that's an avenue for most atheists in Canada. I know that, there is a sort of a sense of apathy that, atheists don't have a bad here, so whatever. But I don't know. I think actually we do kind of have a bad here. And we maybe need to take a closer look at how you're being quietly discriminated against if you're an atheist.
And I mean, the thing with discrimination, it's a weird thing. I mean, I've experienced it in my own life. And don't get me wrong, I'm not hard done by. I have so many advantages being a white male. But there have been times in workplaces where discussions have gone to a theological sort of nature, and people who are my superiors say things like, hey, I can't hurt your feelings, you don't believe in God, right? And you sit there and you say, this is the same person who could, in theory, judge whether I'm going to get the next promotion or not, or my next raise, or, you know, it's... In the grand scheme of things, okay, you know, women have it worse, I think, than most atheists all do. And I think there's still a lot of racism in this country. So I'm not claiming like a lot of Christians do that, hey, we're the worst off in the world. But at the same time, there needs to be an acknowledgement that there is discrimination going on. It needs to be addressed, or at least acknowledged that it exists. And it seems like the Office of Religious Freedoms and this UN thing isn't even getting to the point where it's even acknowledging that it is a thing to be acknowledged.
Yeah, it is depressing. And obviously, you know, we don't want to get into the whole oppression Olympics type thing. There's lots of people who have it bad in this country. We want to lift up everybody. But let's just not forget that there are atheists there, and they need to be lifted up a little bit as well. Well, why don't we, because we are running out of time, why don't we wrap up, I guess, go to our skeptical highlights. What, Don, do you have?
I'm just too depressed. No, I've got a few here. The quickie one, so don't I'm not going to talk too much. So one is the U.S. Consulate General Anne Callahan is giving a lecture at the Fairleigh Dickinson University. That's 842 Canby. She's just going to talk about the priorities of the second Obama administration. Now, normally I don't like talking to politicians because they tend to lie a little bit. But this could be an interesting way to see what the official poop is from the administration, because everything we get tends to be very filtered and very biased from our media outlets. And not that I don't think that this is going to be biased for Obama and that sort of thing, but at least it will be literally unfiltered. The next one, which is also totally unbiased and completely unfiltered, the Harper Monologues, the politics of hate and fear. We've mentioned this before. Apparently, Rage Resistance Rebel presents another dramatic performance, linking a fierce artistic critique of the Harper policy to a clear reminder of power of resistance. This is actually being co-sponsored by the SFU Women's Center and SFU's Out on Campus, groups that are very good and I support. It's going to be held at the SFU Harbor Center, March 21st at 7th. Oh, boy, you know what, Ethan? I forgot to mention Obama Talk. It's tomorrow at 4:30. I forgot to mention. Okay, so let's go back to the Harper Monologues, which is happening Thursday, March 21st at 7:30 at SFU Harbor. Admission is by donation. The other one was free. And finally, a shout out to my Marxist friends. The International Socialist Conference, Ideas to Change the World, is going to be held the 23rd, which is a Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's going to discuss alternatives to the current system, the ongoing Egyptian revolution, Canada's Isle of the Moor, etc. It's going to be held at Langara College, the heartland, the focus center of communism in Canada, or at least BC. Tickets are free. Please show up. If nothing else, you'll learn a bit. You might stretch your opinions about a few things, or you might see how bad Trotskyites don't like each other.
Hmm. Very good. Well, my skeptical highlight, highlights, actually, is coming up on Saturday, April 13th, and that is CFI's book club, and they are reading The Believing Brain by Michael Shermer. I've actually been reading this book myself. It is quite good, I have to say. So check it out. It's quite interesting. You can get it at the Vancouver Public Library or at your local bookstore, and this is happening April 13th, which is a Saturday, 1 p.m. at the Grind and Galley Coffee Shop here in Vancouver. It's free, of course, and it's a great time to come together and discuss an interesting book and other free thought interesting issues. Another cool event coming up that I wanted to... Actually, this is sort of... I'm breaking news, too. On April 24th, which is a Wednesday, CFI is starting a new kind of event. It's sort of like an open forum on all things skeptical activism. So we're going to get together at the Tipper Restaurant, which is over by Kingsway in Vancouver. And the goal is to get together, have some dinner, have a few drinks, socialize for about an hour or so, get to know each other, and then sort of have an open meeting, an open forum, an open discussion on what should CFI be up to? What should we, as skeptical activists, focus our energy on? Should we be talking a lot about religion or politics? Should we get involved with pseudoscience and promoting good science? What would you like to see organized skepticism get up to? And we really want to get your feedback. And at the very least, you're going to get to meet some cool people and hang out, and there'll be some good content. So I encourage you to check that out. That'll be around 7 o'clock, April 24th, which is a Wednesday. And hopefully, if it picks up some steam, we'll be doing it every month.
I'm worried about the ferret conspiracy.
The ferret conspiracy?
You don't think about ferrets, but they're everywhere, and they're taking over the world, man.
They're so cute, though. They're little, like, weasels.
Oh, but they stink.
Well, you can get the stink glands removed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that ethical?
I think they're...
I think we need rights for ferrets. I mean, sitting there and...
I think they have rights, actually. I think the UN explicitly mentions ferrets as protected species.
See, so. I told you. They're taking over.
They have a good lobby group. What can you tell you? Anyway, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. So this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thank you for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way.